It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll dig into the science of how we make decisions with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak.
First, the Attorneys General of Maryland and the District of Columbia filed a federal lawsuit today against President Trump. They're accusing the president of violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution.
Part of the lawsuit includes uncovering the tax returns the president has been unwilling to release so far. Here's a clip from Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frost from a press conference earlier today.
This case is about the right of hundreds of millions of Americans to honest government. Elected leaders who serve the people and not their own financial interests are the indispensable foundation of our democracy. And the president, above all other elected officials, must have only the interests of Americans at the heart of every decision.
Lewis Nelson joins us now. He is a reporter at Politico. Lewis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
We heard a little bit there, but what else have the Attorneys General of Washington, D.C. and Maryland said about why they're suing the president?
Well, at issue, like you brought up in your nice introduction there, was that there's the Emoluments Clause, which has sort of gotten its 15 minutes of fame. As far as constitutional wonks have gone, since President Trump was inaugurated, and that's the part of the Constitution that basically prohibits government officials, people in positions of trust in the government, from accepting foreign titles, gifts, payments from foreign governments. But also at issue in this case is another provision of the Constitution, another sort of emoluments clause. That deals specifically sort of domestically, and what it prohibits is the president is not allowed to supplement his salary, his constitutionally mandated salary, with any other payments from various states or from the federal government. And that comes into play because of the president's hotel, the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. The Trump Organization, which the president still owns, doesn't own that hotel. It leases the property from the General Services Administration, from the federal government. And so that's a business entanglement that these two attorneys general are sort of highlighting in this lawsuit that they filed today.
Can you talk a little bit about what the Emoluments Clause was designed to do initially?
Yeah, so the Emoluments Clause obviously was never completely intended or was not written with the type of wealth that Donald Trump has in mind. It's fairly easy to imagine the sort of framers and of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers not totally being able to conceptualize the sort of international business entanglements or the types of business deals or just the sheer amount of wealth that President Donald Trump has been able to amass. The Emoluments Clause dealt initially, when it was first written, with things as simple as George Washington, the sale of George Washington's agriculture products, products from his farm abroad, overseas, things like that. So this is certainly a unique test. President Trump's sort of vast business empire is certainly a unique test of the Emoluments Clause.
We're talking with Lewis Nelson right now, reporter for Politico, joining us to talk about the news that the attorneys general of Maryland and D.C. are suing President Trump. And Lewis, President Trump has had the plan, and he formed that trust and handed control of his businesses to his two sons. What are the legal sticking points in that arrangement for some critics?
Well, the legal sticking points, the White House would tell you, are very few. There are a decent number of sort of conflict of interest laws, federal conflict of interest laws, that simply do not apply to the president of the United States. The White House's line has been that the president legally cannot have a conflict of interest, and that's not entirely true. There are certain laws that apply to the president, but not all of them do. The sticking points are sort of more customary. Traditionally, presidents have held themselves to this standard of putting their assets into a blind trust, a trust that is outside of their control, that they don't know the sort of comings and goings of it. The idea being that when a president makes a decision that might have financial ramifications, he's making that decision with the interests of the country in mind and not the interests of his, his own portfolio. What President Trump has done is something short of that. President Trump has placed control of the Trump Organization, which is amounts to, the bulk of his assets, under the control of his two adult sons. That's Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr. And while the president, while the Trump Organization rather has said that the president doesn't have any day-to-day control of the Trump Organization, it is not a blind trust. For it to be a truly blind trust, you would have to there would have to be no discussion of the family business between Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and the president. And they have said as much, that is not true. Eric Trump, a week or two ago, I believe, in an interview, said that he still shares certain pieces of information with the president, things like profit reports from the Trump Organization. He shares them, I think he said, quarterly. So that is not by any means a blind trust. And so those who have been critical of the president have said that he's falling short of the ethical standards set by his predecessors.
Now, you mentioned the Trump Hotel in D.C. Leased from the General Services Administration. Are there other specific examples in the lawsuit that those bringing it see as violations of that emoluments clause?
Well, the Trump International Hotel is the big one, and that one has already been subject to some other sort of legal wranglings and legal disputes. The General Services Administration, my memory is failing me a little bit, either right before Trump was inaugurated or shortly after, basically had to come out with a ruling that the Trump Organization's lease with the GSA did not violate the emoluments clause. That the presence of the hotel and Donald Trump being president at the same time were okay, was acceptable. Other issues, though, have a lot to do with foreign governments, foreign businesses, foreign business dealings that the Trump Organization has, and then sort of by connection that the president himself has through the organization that he still owns. And the full extent of those, still remains unknown. The president has refused to release his tax returns. Those would be, fairly crucial documents in sort of determining the full scope of his international business obligations and international business ties.
Right, and that's a big feature of this lawsuit, correct? That if the attorneys bringing it are going to request to see these personal tax returns, and that is yet to be made public, and even if it is something that the attorney general get to see, it probably won't, it sounds like, go public. But is that expected to be a big flashpoint?
Yeah, it certainly is. The president has not released his tax returns yet, as you said, as has been well reported. And it certainly, by all indications, is that he doesn't intend to release them anytime soon, although the White House has continued to say that he will release them once they're no longer under audit. But it's hard to see a light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the tax returns actually coming out anytime soon. And so the question there, is that whether or not they actually are available to these attorneys general, I think it is something that is likely to be pursued if this case is allowed to go forward. It's likely to be pursued and could conceivably be pursued all the way up to the Supreme Court.
And what are you watching for next in this case?
Well, this is sort of an addition to the sort of already growing mountain of legislation that the Trump administration is facing. There is another sort of similar lawsuit that has a lot of parallels that was filed by an organization called the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. That's a watchdog group. That group is also acting as an acting counsel for this legislation brought by the two attorneys general. There's litigation involving the president's executive order about the travel bans. There is sure to be litigation about the border wall that the president has promised, certainly involving eminent domain and the government's ability to, gather up the land to actually build the wall and support all the infrastructure for it. This is increasingly, any White House is involved in a lot of litigation, but for the attorneys general of a state and of the District of Columbia to file a lawsuit against the president of the United States is certainly noteworthy and adds to the sort of mounting pile of ongoing high-profile lawsuits that the president and his team, his administration, have to face, and this is the sort of thing they'd rather not be dealing with when they want to be pushing things like the Obamacare repeal and replace, things like a tax reform package, a big overhaul of that, things like a massive infrastructure package that they'd like to work with Democrats on. So this is, if nothing else, certainly a distraction from the president's political agenda.
Lewis, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Anytime.
That was Lewis Nelson, a reporter for Politico, joining us to talk about news that the attorneys general of Maryland and D.C. are suing President Trump.
Now, we make decisions every day, from things as small as what shirt to wear to bigger things like whether or not to take out that second mortgage. Recent science has started to unravel the inner workings of how we really make decisions, and it might surprise you.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us about once a month to share the latest science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time. Gemma, you with us? No, you're there. I'm sure we'll be able to hear you in just a second. Gemma, are you with us?
Yes, I'm
there.
Here.
There we go. Yeah.
I knew you were there. Excellent. Lovely to
wow,
hear your voice, though.
Wow, keeping me on my toes.
Deciding whether or not to answer. No, I think that was on our end, actually.
Well, now that you're with us, Gemma, let's talk about the science of decision-making. This is something that you have a piece about in Discover Magazine. What have we learned about the latest to how we make decisions?
Yeah, this is really fascinating because I think most of us like to think that we're kind of a little bit Spockish when it comes to decision making. You know, we weigh the pros and the cons, and we choose based on experience and everything. And over time, researchers have found that humans can be incredibly irrational about how they make decisions. But at the same time, we can make decisions based on, it's not even irrationality. It's based on these subconscious ideas and experiences that we don't even know that we have.
Right. I've read, and I read in the piece and discovered that some people are really good at making gut decisions on the spur of the moment, but that's usually only if they have years and years of experience on that subject.
Right, right. It's kind of like muscle memory in a trained boxer. You know, they're not thinking, oh, this guy's coming in this way, I'm going to hit him this way. It's called pattern matching. And it's basically, it's an analysis that occurs without even our knowledge, taking in the sensory information that and then matching it to past experiences. And this theory really came to light after a researcher looked at how first responders and military commanders were making decisions. And especially among the more experienced of these individuals, he found that they seemed to make these snap judgments rather than carefully weighing the pros and cons. And that's because, without even thinking about it, they were using pattern matching. It was all occurring without them sitting down and thinking about it. They were just doing it instantaneously, almost, much like, as I mentioned, a muscle memory.
So what happens with the rest of us, maybe, when we don't have 20 years of muscle memory on any given field and we have to make a decision? What kinds of decisions do we end up making?
Well, they found basically that the prevailing theory is that we really make decisions based on one of two systems. And system one, you can think of it as the snap judgment system. It's very quick. It's automatic. You don't stop to weigh the pros and cons. And it can be very valuable, but it's also very vulnerable to biases that you might not know you have. So, you know, for example, oh, that guy, he's got long hair. He must be up to no good.
Hey. Wait a minute.
I'm just giving you an example. Just giving you an example. But, you know, or for me, if I see someone driving a certain type of car, this is terrible, but a certain make and model of car, I think, oh, man, that guy is going to try to cut me off. You know, that's like another example that has nothing to do with hair. So those are very snap judgments, and they tend to be very fast and more emotional. Sometimes it's called implicit knowledge, and it's the result of connecting. This is the sciencey, super sciencey part of it. It's the result of connections between groups of neurons that form during repeated exposure. And that's why we think, oh, that guy looks like an ex-boyfriend that I don't like, so I'm not going to like him, or he's a bad guy. You know, it's that kind of judgment area. But system two, in terms of decision-making, that is the Spock decision-making process. It's analytical, it's deliberate, it's weighing the pros and cons, and that can be very valuable for, if example, you are thinking about taking out that second mortgage. The problem is it takes more time and more brain power to do. So if you're in a situation where you have, you know, say a reckless driver coming at you head on and you have to pick which is the best way to avoid him, you don't want to really engage in that slow, deliberative process.
And even in less of a crisis situation, I've certainly been here, I think a lot of people have, where you start weighing the pros and cons of a decision, buying a new appliance or whatever, and you can really quickly go down a rabbit hole and end up with no decision at all. And ultimately, it comes back to that snap judgment system anyway.
Sure, for some people, you know, we all make our decisions a little bit differently. But what really fascinated me was that this theory of System 1 and System 2 emerged in the late 20th century. But if you go all the way back to ancient Greece and Plato, you know, he didn't get everything right, but he got a few things right. Plato actually compared human will and decision-making to a charioteer with two horses, one representing rational impulses and the other representing irrational passions. So even back in ancient Greece, Plato was kind of on to the System 1, System 2 duality of our decision-making process.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting caught up on the latest in science news. And Gemma, forensic evidence is big on TV, but we don't realize sometimes it goes back a long way. We're going to talk about some of the latest stuff, but first, can you tell us about that very first example of a kind of forensic investigation in China?
Yeah, and I love this, and I can't believe there isn't like a CSI in medieval China yet. But basically, a field worker in 13th century China was unfortunately killed with a sickle. And everyone in the village had a sickle, and they all looked alike. So the investigator trying to find the killer had every worker lay their tool down in a field. And he found that only one sickle was attracting blowflies, which seek out blood. And so he said, yep, this is the sickle, and its owner confessed. So that's kind of like the earliest CSI episode ever, 13th century China. Mm. We've progressed quite a bit since then, I'm happy to say.
Now, there's been some controversy about recent forensic evidence, people putting too much faith in it, but we're starting to get new with DNA and other things, new and what are hopefully more reliable indicators that can help tell a story of what happened in a crime and hopefully solve it.
Yeah, and you know, what I love about this field is it's going in so many different directions, but they're all really interesting, and they're all pretty rigorous science-wise. So, for example, the microbial clock. You know, you always see on Law & Order, I don't know about you, but I kind of binge-watch the Law & Order marathons. I seriously have a problem with that, but they're always like, the first thing they ask is, well, when is the body in rigor? How long, you know, has the body been there? Because what's the state of rigor mortis? And that's not really precise. There are a couple other ways to tell how long a body has been there, when was a person was killed, but they're all not that precise. Now, however, scientists are working out a microbial clock, and basically the microbes inside the body go through this very regular, consistent pattern in terms of which microbes are present and what they're doing. And so using this newly developed microbial clock, they are able to tell within 2 to 4 days over a 25-day period of when the body was put at the spot, either when the individual was killed there or even if the individual was moved from another spot. And, you know, it's a gruesome thing to talk about, but at the same time, how great is it that we're getting closer to really being able to find people who have done terrible things?
And Gemma, before we move on to our last topic, there's some new stuff there also with augmented reality, right?
Yeah. You know, the great thing is all of these new techniques involving microbes and now using protein identification the same way we kind of use DNA, these are all super high-tech, super important to make sure that they are collected from the crime scene without contamination. But you don't want 50, 60, 70 people traipsing through your crime scene, one guy picking up the proteins, one guy picking up this. So what they're using now is augmented reality, and they're starting this program in the Netherlands. And what they're doing is basically sending the crime scene investigator to the scene of the crime with kind of a body cam, if you want to think about it that way, plus a wrist monitor. So he is interacting with remote experts, potentially anywhere in the world, who can see what he's seeing, who can type him notes in real time, who can even mark on the monitor, hey, we want you to take a second look at this spot, or hey, let's make sure we dust for prints on this spot. So it really, it opens up the crime scene without bringing a lot of people actually to the crime scene and potentially contaminating it.
And Gemma, finally, you wrote about a mystery 350 million years in the making, when our first ancestors came out of the water onto land. What's the state of the art in terms of when, why, and how that happened?
Well, we don't know exactly when. And we don't know exactly which animal, but we're starting to really piece together how. And quite frankly, this is a huge moment in evolution, because when these aquatic animals moved onto land and became fully terrestrial, and we're talking about vertebrates here, they evolved, talk about a diverse bunch, they evolved into dinosaurs, birds, mammals, amphibians, everything pretty much with a spine on the land came from these tetrapods that were moving onto land around 365 million years ago. And basically, we're figuring out in new fossil hotspots, like in southern Scotland in particular, we're figuring out really how they came to land. And they may have been washed in a storm surge, or they may have been living in these river systems where there's a lot of fluctuation in the water level. And it's just fascinating stuff. And they just found 12 new species. In December, they published the results. So every day, we're learning more and more about it.
Well, we'll have to talk more about that. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's always fun.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us about once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about new research on contaminated drinking water in Kewaunee County wells.
First, think of a community with high rates of poverty, large numbers of people on federal assistance, rising divorce rates, high unemployment, and growing drug problem. There's a good chance that you think of an inner city.
But increasingly, those problems and others are a part of life in rural America. A new report from the Wall Street Journal finds that rural counties are, on average, seeing the worst trends in the nation in a wide variety of areas, including health, education, the economy, and more.
Paul Overberg is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal and co-author of the piece Rural America is the New Inner City. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we laid out some of the trends there, but can you give us the big picture of cities apparently for the most part improving on many measures and rural areas going the opposite direction?
Yes, and it's that sort of flip or conversion from what most people in the last generation have been familiar with that was most surprising to us and to a lot of our readers.
So give us a couple, you did a couple case studies in the midst of the big picture numbers. You looked at the communities of Coffeyville, Kansas, and Hardin County, Kentucky. Can you paint a picture of what you saw in those communities?
It was actually Hardin County. It was a little town in Hardin County, Ohio, called Kenton. And, it was a small town, used to have a decent supply of manufacturing, and that's gone away, and a combination of the town's population is aging, and the jobs not being there, young people who grew up there often leave. So it's a variety of things that have sort of created a problem. You know, there's rising crime rates, there's the opioid epidemic, which seems to be everywhere in this country these days, so it's created all kinds of problems in that people there just aren't used to dealing with in terms of petty crime and things like that. And in Coffeyville, Kansas, a small town in southeastern Kansas, it's the same sort of thing where they actually had an early Amazon distribution center that back when Amazon still was trying to locate in small rural areas and avoid sales taxes for its customers. But now that it wants to have its distribution centers close to where the population is because of its speed of distribution and two-day shipping and things like that, it closed it a few years ago, and they're still trying to find a new occupant. That killed a lot of jobs in a little town like that.
In the piece, you shared some numbers and some charts that were really surprising, things that broke down the United States in kind of four different demographic groups, from big cities on down in population density to these smaller rural, lower populated rural areas. And the rural areas come out the worst in so many different categories. The rising numbers of federal people on federal disability aid, rural counties lead the nation, apparently. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Just to cover that real quickly, that we, you know, there's a lot of ways of sort of breaking down this country in terms of urban and rural and everything in between. And you can say rural to some people and they think tumbleweeds blowing across the prairie. And that's a sort of an extreme view. What we tried to do was look at it in terms of big cities and then their suburbs as one group, as two groups, and then sort of mid-sized cities and their suburbs. And then finally, any place that has a, that's outside of all the metropolitan areas, but has at least a city of maybe 10 to 20,000 people, and then the more rural areas than that. So we're talking about a seventh of the country population-wise, about 45 or 6 million people. So it's a pretty good share of the population. And the disability thing was surprising because, but once we sort of did more research on it, it made sense. These are places where, I mean, the federal disability program standards have been changed in the last 20 years to admit people who have not just physical disability issues, but mental disability issues. And often those can stem from substance abuse or go along with substance abuse issues. It's also, in some ways, it's a safety net program that's still there, unlike others that have been sort of whittled back in the last 10, 15 years. So it's often sort of the program of last resort for a lot of these folks.
Talking to Paul Overberg from the Wall Street Journal about problems in rural America, things people used to associate with inner cities showing up more and more in rural America. Health outcomes, Paul, you covered too, and survival rates for people with heart problems and cancer are way worse in these rural communities you looked at than in many others. Why is that?
So this is a case where there's a lot of good news nationwide because our ability to deal with cancer is getting better, but it's getting better faster where obviously healthcare is strongest, and that's in urban areas. That's where and it's a combination of both the treatment side, the sophisticated treatments that need specialists and specialized facilities and drugs and people who can monitor them and follow up. But it's also on the other side. It's on the prevention side, too. And one of the problems that you can see in America is that, for instance, smoking rates are higher in rural areas. Well, that creates all kinds of problems down the road when cancer ensues. And it shows up in the lung disease rates as well.
And then social issues, divorce higher in rural areas, teen birth rate trends going down everywhere, it looked like on your charts, but highest now, which it didn't used to be in, rural areas. So these are, it's not just an economic issue, it's not just health issues, but these what people I think would call social issues too.
Right, and birth to teenagers has been a problem that, you know, we've sort of recognized for a long time that creates all kinds of problems down the road, both for the women who are having these children. It really limits their ability to, say, finish high school or get a college degree, which limits their earnings prospects. It creates much more likelihood that they're going to raise these children without a steady partner, and that creates all kinds of problems for the kids. So everybody's sort of known this for a long time, and there's been lots of efforts at a variety of approaches to try to limit this sort of thing. And these seem to, for whatever reason, the audience and or the message seem to come together better in big cities where the teen birth rates have really dropped starkly. And this is part of sort of the cultural divide in the country. There's different religious and cultural attitudes in small town America about this sort of thing. So I think that's a piece of it, too. That creates an impediment or a problem in terms of social services, but also just sort of the ability of these women to get jobs, hold jobs, to move up the job ladder, all that sort of thing. And divorce, one of the things that's happened in the last, especially since the recession, is the millennial generation has been much slower to move into marriage than previous generations, and the millennial generation's also done a fair amount of sort of voting with their feet towards more larger cities, not just the biggest cities, but larger cities. So one of the things that happens when that happens is that if people don't get married, they don't get divorced. So the divorce rates are dropping fastest in big cities, or the number of people who are adults who are divorced has dropped most in those places.
Let's get into some of the causes now. I mean, going from this place where we viewed the inner cities, you know, back in the 80s and beyond as kind of the low point, the place where all the problems were. Now, improvements there, problems in rural America. What happened?
Well, it's not that the problems in cities have gone away, but it's maybe the good news is that for a variety of reasons, both things that we've sort of tackled as a nation in terms of social policy and a lot of money have been aimed at that problem ever since, you know, cities started really ailing in the 1960s. But also there's sort of broader demographic currents and economic currents that have nothing to do with what policymakers and politicians can focus on. So immigration is a much bigger deal today than it was even 10 years ago, much less 20 years ago. And most immigrants start in big cities. Those tend to be very much young adults, and they are strivers. They've often had to go through tremendous obstacles to get here. And those are also people who are having, you know, they're at their prime family forming years. So they tend to have, you know, there's more children there. That creates a younger, more vital population. That creates all kinds of, you know, beneficial effects, even though it creates short-term costs in trying to absorb and acculturate these people.
We're talking to Paul Overberg from the Wall Street Journal, talking about the problems facing rural America, problems that have been commonly associated in the past with inner cities.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Why do you think that rural areas are seeing these problems, things like poverty, declining population, and concerns about crime and addiction? Is this a story maybe in your community? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Paul Overberg from the Wall Street Journal. He's co-written a piece called Rural America is the New Inner City.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're in a rural community, are you seeing some of these problems? Declining population, no job opportunities, poverty, addiction, crime, young people moving away to bigger cities. Is your community doing something to try to turn things around? Do you see policy solutions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, you've written in the past about the politics surrounding these communities here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. A lot of these rural counties are places that switched from supporting a Democratic presidential candidate to a Republican one, in this case, Donald Trump, enough maybe to sway electoral votes, which were enough to sway the election. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Last year, my colleague on this story, Janet Adamy, and I, we were working on other stories, just trying to help people understand the what was in people's minds as Donald Trump was gaining strength and showing sort of surprising popularity across the country. And we did a story, actually it was published just before the election, where we found that there was a tremendous sort of matchup between the places where he, in the primary elections, in the counties where he had polled well, and places that had seen a rapid rise in what's called the diversity index, basically the chance that two people are from a different race or ethnic group, and places where that had surged in the last 15 years. In other words, all of a sudden, there's a lot more people who are different compared to, say, 10 or 15 years ago. Those were the counties where he did did best, and a lot of those counties were in Wisconsin and sort of central Pennsylvania, all over northern Iowa, places like that. Places where, as it turns out, we redid the analysis with the general election returns and found the exact same pattern, that he had, you know, very strong support in those places. And in some cases, it may have helped in tip some of these states like Wisconsin that had previously been Democratic.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Norwalk. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lisa?
I just was wondering if it had been thought about that maybe some of the problem might have to do with it's financially easier to live in rural communities, so sometimes you get big people from bigger cities moving in, and then it's harder for the kids to like acclimate or to feel a sense of belonging, because a lot of times families in small towns have actually been there for such a long time.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Paul, it seems like most of the population movement is out of rural America, not to these smaller towns. Is that right?
Right. There's always an in and an out. And, you know, going back 100 years, when more than half or two-thirds of the country lived in rural areas and farms and small towns, there's been a steady sort of movement away from there, and it goes faster and slower at various times. One of the things that's happened a lot in the last 20 years is that the inflow to these places has really slowed down, and the people who used, because a lot of those people maybe grew up in rural areas, moved away to college or to make their money, but then moved back. Well, that coming back hasn't happened, or that inflow hasn't happened. So it's sort of a drying up of the supply, and that's one of the things that's creating the problems of population decline in rural areas.
Right. You also paint a demographic picture, population decline in rural areas, aging, a big average age difference between rural and urban America, and education. As you say, that college student who moved out is less likely to come back. So you have this big gap in college-educated people in cities and suburbs versus the rural areas.
Right. If you think about, small-town America was, even, say, 100, 120 years ago, was sort of the birthplace of a lot of the manufacturing in this country, which didn't really sort of become a massive urban phenomenon until the 1920s and 30s, and certainly the 1940s during the war. So there's always been manufacturing in small towns, and that's where a lot of America's biggest manufacturers started. So there was always those kinds of jobs around where if you couldn't inherit your family's farm or something like that, there was a possibility. With the erosion of that in the last 15 years, there's just not a lot of places for a lot of those people who are growing up there. And also the erosion of what are called middle-skill jobs. You know, think about where healthcare jobs and finance jobs, two of the fastest growing sectors of the economy, are clustering. They cluster in big clusters in big cities. So, even if you want to go become a nurse assistant or an accountant, more and more of that work is in bigger places.
Lisa, thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Paul Overberg from the Wall Street Journal. He has a piece, co-wrote a piece on what we used to think of as inner city problems, poverty, addiction, joblessness, health problems that we used to associate with inner cities, now more and more the case in rural America. And Paul, you and your colleague talked to some policymakers on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, who I think both agreed they'd overlooked these communities.
They had. And, you know, the emphasis ever since the 1960s has been on the problems of our cities, certainly at the federal level, and a lot of states have had to focus on, you know, the problems of their particular biggest city and the urban ills, because there's no doubt about it. The sort of the way trends were running in the 1950s and 60s between racial trends and the dispersion of population out the suburbs with the interstate highway system and all the new land that was opened up in suburbs, it really created a real problem in terms of the wealth and the possibility of cities just was being eroded and creating huge social costs. So everybody focused on that, and, you know, small towns had sort of always taken care of themselves. And they were, you know, in small town cultures, you know, people are proud about that sort of thing. We take care of each other. And, you know, tides changed and things have now turned around.
I wanted to ask about broadband and internet access. You wrote in your piece that that was hoped to be a lifesaver. If we had better internet access, it would allow people who wanted to live in a smaller community to do whatever job they wanted to do as long as they could be connected online. So far, that doesn't seem to have come to fruition.
Right, and that's maybe a good example of how we've always had a country that's as big as the whole, goes clear across the continent. We've always had these bargains to figure out how to bridge this urban-rural divide between very dispersed and very urban populations when new economic things come along. So you think about rural free delivery when the Postal Service started doing that. That really facilitated all kinds of things. That made life a lot better all on small towns and farms. And the rural electrification program that the Roosevelt administration helped sort of facilitate in the New Deal, that sort of helped bridge the fact that, well, it really is going to be pretty expensive to bring electricity all the way out down, you know, a 10-mile country road to somebody in Nebraska. But we figured it out. Somehow we haven't quite figured that out yet. And it would probably make a lot of everything from telemedicine to, bringing AP chemistry classes to some rural high school, it would make life a lot easier and more palatable and work to benefit these places. But we just haven't figured it out in terms of how are we going to, you know, share the costs.
Now, looking back again, inner cities were seen as the trouble spot, a lot of attention paid to them, not all the problems solved, obviously, but we've seen big improvements. Do you see a consensus forming that, holy cow, we got to do something about these rural areas? We need a focus of state and federal policies to try to turn things around?
I'm not sure I see a consensus forming, but I do see in especially a lot of the shock that people who live in coastal areas, dense populated areas, a lot of the shock that they felt in seeing what happened in the election is starting to sink in terms of who are these people who vote this way and why are they thinking this way. So I think there might be more of an openness to looking at what sort of brought us to this point, and why would this happen, and maybe pay more attention to these problems. I think the opioid epidemic especially has sort of created a better understanding in the public health field and in the law enforcement field that there's sort of deeply rooted problems, and getting control of that is going to require sort of deep solutions in the fabric of these communities.
We'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Paul Overberg. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's the co-author of a piece on problems facing rural America titled Rural America is the New Inner City. The basic idea, a lot of problems that a couple decades ago we might have thought of as inner city problems, poverty, drugs, unemployment, bad health outcomes, we're seeing more and more in rural communities and small towns. Still time for you to share your thoughts, by the way. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We have a link to the piece he co-wrote there, and you can tell us what's going on in your rural community. That's the Central Time Facebook page.
If you've ever enjoyed a pizza with pineapple and Canadian bacon, or maybe mocked someone else for eating one, you have Sam Panopoulos to thank for it. And he passed away last week at the age of 83.
The combo of pineapple and Canadian bacon, or other ham product, was invented really far from Hawaii. Panopoulos was a Greek immigrant in Ontario, Canada. He and his brother threw some canned pineapple on a pizza back in the 1960s for a laugh and as an experiment. They had a pizzeria. It caught on, it made it onto their menu, and it became an international hit.
And let it be said, in international controversy, and earlier this year, the president of Iceland joked with a group of high school students that he would ban pineapple from pizza if he could. And when word got out about that, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau went online to defend the honor of his country and its pizza.
All in good fun, but some people seriously dislike Hawaiian pizza and pineapple on pizza. Where do you stand on this international controversy?
I remember the day that a friend suggested pineapple on the pizza and was very opposed to it, and so a battle ensued. We ended up getting the pineapple, and I loved it, and I still do.
Yeah, and there's something about the pineapple and the ham or ham-like product together that really goes together well. It's not something... It's like a sometimes pizza topping for me. I'm not going to get it every time. Once in a while, it really hits the spot.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's worth trying. So anyone who's in denial, give it a go.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.